Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Jan Otto will be speaking on Reflections of the Sabbath, Mark 2. So let's listen in on Jan.
We also need to finish the parable of the sower, which we started yesterday. So I'm afraid we're probably going to shortchange Sabbath a bit, but at least I'm going to start with a few readings about the Sabbath. That way, at least anyone who might pick up the tape and, you know, be disappointed that they thought they were going to have a shortcut Bible study on the Sabbath won't maybe be too embarrassed that, or I won't be too embarrassed they picked up a tape and didn't have anything on it having to do with it. Normally what we would do with this on this day if we had finished our parable is that we would take a look at what Jesus' theology of the Sabbath was. And there is a particular incident in Mark chapter, I think it's 2, that we might, if we're really good, might get to and at least look at how he goes about the Sabbath. I think for a lot of times we seem to think of the Sabbath as a legal obligation that was a real stumbling block for him and the Jewish leadership. And often it's not, I have a feeling that in Christian circles we're just beginning to recapture the beauty of the Sabbath and what that's about. And this is the Sabbath day for Jews. And I thought it was appropriate that this morning we might talk just a bit about that. I have a reading from Abraham Heschel, who is a modern Jewish person, having to do with the Sabbath. And I thought we'd at least begin with this as a sort of devotion for the day. He says, Judaism is a religion of time. Judaism is a religion of time, aiming at the sanctification of time. I'll read that one more time. Judaism is a religion of time, aiming at the sanctification of time. Unlike the space-minded people, or people who are minded as to space, to whom time is unvaried and homogeneous, to whom all hours are alike, as empty shells, the Bible instead senses the diversified nature of time. There are no 2 hours alike. Each hour is unique, and only one given at the moment is exclusive and endlessly precious. Judaism teaches us to be attached to holiness in time, to be attached to sacred events, to learn how to consecrate sanctuaries that emerge from the magnificent stream of a year. The Sabbaths are our great cathedrals, and our Holy of Holies is a shrine that neither the Romans nor the Germans were able to burn, a shrine that even apostasy cannot easily obliterate. According to the ancient rabbis, it is not the observance of the Sabbath, but the day itself, the essence of the day. I'm going to stop there in the reading. So many times we are concerned with items of space. The Jews, however, have looked at time instead of space. So many times the space they have been in has been in oppression or in foreign countries or whatever. They have not been able to necessarily find that space that's holy. Oftentimes they've not had a holy space, but they've always had a holy time. In the Greek New Testament, there are two words used for time. The first one, I'll write as large as I can, is the word chronos, meaning chronological time. Time that's counted like the hours on a clock. Time that's looked at like the pages of a calendar, the years, even the seasons having to do with the agricultural time. But there's another word as well that's used in the Greek, and that is the word for time that means, that is kairos. Kairos time is not chronology. It is not quantity. It's quality. Kairos deals with events that are significant in your life. You'll know how to distinguish Kairos from Chronos time in your own life by thinking about how old you are. That's your Chronos time. Your Kairos time would be the answer to a question like this. What are the four most significant moments that you can remember in your life up to this time? Chances are those will be events, moments of relationship, or something so significant that today you can remember it as if you were still there, even though it may have occurred 20, 30, 50, or 70 or more years ago. Frederick Buechner, I think, helps us with this understanding of time in a book that he wrote about himself. He said that he calls this moments of time with a capital T, that the moments of chronology are moments of time with a small t, but Kairos moments have a capital T. And he said that one of the most important Kairos moments for him was when he was just a young boy. And he was in his bedroom early one Saturday morning. And his father came to the door and he looked in and their eyes met. And he backed out of the room and he closed the door and he heard his father, he still hears his father, walk down that hallway into his own bedroom. And within 20 seconds, he heard a gunshot. And his father killed himself. For Buechner, that was a moment of Kairos time. It was a moment from which he would never be the same. And even though he is now a grown man, he remembers it as if it still had just happened moments ago. Do you have experiences like that of Kairos? Can you think of some in your own life? Most of us can. That is the quality of time the Jews wanted the Sabbath to be. It wasn't just an observance of the law, it was to take a time apart and celebrate it as the event that it is. Remember that God gave the Sabbath as the end of the seventh day of creation. It's not that the creation ended and then God rested. The creation was finished as far as the productivity of it on the sixth day, but the seventh day is included as part of the creation. It's as if rest and productivity go together as part of God's plan. And I think what Jewish people tend to want us to realize is that all of our time is holy time. Not just the Sabbath day, but every day. Every moment, God is closer to us than our own breath. So that what Jesus, I think, is attempting to do in talking about the Sabbath is to get back to the Sabbath not observed as a moment of chronos, a certain 24-hour period, but a quality time that one spends. And that quality is part of the creative order. That's as much as I want to say at this point on Sabbath. Do you have any comments you'd like to make on the Sabbath day for Jews, about the Sabbath or about anything dealing with time?
The Kairos moment has to be something that we experience ourselves. I mean, it wouldn't be like birth or someone else doing something farther away.
Probably. I think it's something we ourselves recognize as a quality moment. Your birth probably was a Kairos event for your mother and your father. That's interesting to think that we might be Kairos events for other people. When the scriptures talk about and use the phrase, and the time was fulfilled, they are not talking about chronological time. They're talking about Kairos. What that phrase means is that when the certain events and all the situations and all those quality episodes have taken place, time is literally full. And now the next Kairos event takes place. Even when the disciples talk to Jesus about his return, his second coming, they ask him questions that use in the Greek the word chronos. When will you come back? And he always answers them with Kairos. They keep asking for Chronos, and he keeps answering in Kairos. Very interesting, very interesting.
Do you think the 7 days of creation are chronos times or kairos times?
I think they're kairos times. Caught in the midst of chronos. Chronos is kind of the shell with which we work, and in there is kairos. I like to think of eternity as the breakdown of the stranglehold of chronos, and we will live constantly in kairos. How exciting. And that's why the Sabbath has been so important to Jews, because it is that one day, it's that crown, it's the queen of the calendar, I think sometimes it's called, that begins to show a picture of what life forever is like. And they said that on the Sabbath day, it should be a day in which one recognizes the presence of the love of God for you. To celebrate the presence of God with one another, and that husband and wife should always make love on the Sabbath. Isn't that incredible? See, for there's no breakdown between things that are sacred and secular, as if sexuality is something bad. It's that life is meant, and the Sabbath is meant as a day of love, both expressed to God and especially through one another. How radical. In any case, so much for the Sabbath. We're going to move back now, abruptly, to the parable of the sower. And I want to hand these out. If you brought yours, that's great. If you didn't, there's a copy for you. And I want to talk about a couple things that came up in class yesterday. Let's up a bit. Make sure I get a wrench to fix this meeting stand before I leave. I'm here for another week, so I'll start over on Monday with a whole new set of topics on Mark. It's going to be a lot of fun, I think. In any case, there were two things that were brought up yesterday in this hour, and we had a good discussion. And at first hour, there were some of those people at 9 who were 9 o'clock yesterday who came to 8:30. We had a good group, good-sized group at 8:30 here, or 7:45 here, rather. So, in any case, one of the things had to do with the average yield in Israel. Remember, I gave you a figure. There it is. I counted. 7.5%. Actually, it's sevenfold. I shouldn't use percentage figures. That's probably not as accurate. Well, actually, in that figure, it is 7%. I don't know what happened to that. Yeah. See, I'm lost when I can't write.
Yeah, their instructor came in, remember? She took one with her.
That helps. Well, you go back and take the back from the other.
How about using the chalk?
Yeah, I will. I just think it's easier to see this board.
You got a black one up there, don't you?
No, it's yellow, and there's a small, tiny blue one. I don't think you can read it. Anyway, 7.5%. Well, I kind of was startled by the question because it was kind of a given. It's been a given in biblical study for a number of years. I've been studying Bible formally for almost 20 years, and that has been used from almost square one when you talked about the parable. So I didn't see it. I guess I came in not thinking of it as being that's something I need to look up and find out where it comes from. So yesterday, in the Holden Library, of which it's more impressive for its size all the time, I did some looking to find out where this figure comes from. And it comes from the work of a man whose name is G. Dahlmann, who wrote in German, Arbeit und Sitte in Palästina, and this means work and custom in Palestine. He wrote seven whole volumes between the year 1928 and 1942. One of those volumes deals with agriculture. And through his scholarship, which, whether it's reliable or not, I don't know, but let's put it this way, this is where the number 7.5 to 10 comes from. It's from him. And it's been used ever since then by Bible scholars as the average yield. In fact, even in this brand new volume, he uses 10% or 10 as that number. The person that first used it in parable study was a man who is behind a rebirth of the study of parables in the 70s, a man by the name of Joachim Jeremias. Everybody that's gone to seminary has studied Jeremias, right? So be it, yeah, we know this person. Well, this is back in about 1970 or so, and he lived in Palestine, and he just says, well, yeah, it's really poor soil, and it's just nothing grows. So whether it's accurate or not, I can't say, but this is where it comes from. I didn't make it up. I received it. So what I did find, however, for your interest, is in a book, a handbook about the Bible, I found a modern picture of Syria and a farmer plowing. This was in color, so it must be modern. So I'll have you take a look at these pictures, a little bit of information about hoes and hoeing. But what the archaeologists tell us is that the blades of the implements that have been recovered, the furrows could have been no more than about 5 inches deep. And that Palestine is a very rocky place. Remember, we don't know about irrigation, we don't know about soil. And frankly, when it comes to this parable, Jesus is telling this as a story to catch us, not as a description of modern agriculture. It's not a farming lesson. And so, basically, we talked about this morning, when we finally got to the end of the parable, everyone said, well, it didn't make any difference anyway, did it? And I said, well, no. But I want to say that, you know, I'm trying to be as accurate as I can. So that's what we know. If you want to find that work, I've never seen it. I don't read German. Even if I could find it, I probably would struggle through it. So that's the source from which it comes. Maybe there's updated things. That I don't know. But of course, you know, as we say, conditions have changed. How do we know? The only thing I can guess is that he probably based his work out of some records from the Greek and or Roman Empire dealing with taxes, because everything that was raised in the farmlands was taxed by Rome, as well as the Jewish temple. So there wasn't a whole lot left. But maybe, if anything, that may show us just how poor these people were. These were not middle-class folks. These were poor folks, and a real hand-to-mouth existence. And so, just as a comment. The other thing I looked at yesterday was this phrase, birds of the air. Gail, would you be willing to run upstairs to the office and get us a marquee pen for this board, please?
Thank you.
Okay, whatever. Give me something, because I can't in this way. The phrase birds of the air. That's what my husband is for. He loves to be helpful.
He's the maverick.
Yeah, he's the maverick. Right. He's great.
He's so good.
He really is. He is just a wonderful person. The birds of the air phrase has been used from the very beginning of the scriptures to mean a lot of different things. Oh, not a lot of different. In a lot of different contexts. I'm writing and trying to talk, and I often end up saying something that I would later regret. I'm going to give just a few of these on the board of at least four uses of this phrase, birds of the air, and then talk a little bit about where this comes from and why I said what I said yesterday. You see, Holden's Bible studies are so much shorter than I'm used to working, and I sometimes take shortcuts. And when I do, I get myself in trouble because I've not allowed you as adults to discover this information. Thankfully, at home, I can do a little better job. The phrase birds of the air starts right in the book of Genesis, from the moment of creation when God creates the birds of the air. And in certain places in the scriptures, it is meant literally the birds of the air, the ones that tweet and fly out in the trees. In Psalm 104, that is one usage of basically the birds of the air as birds. Okay? Nothing significant, just plain ordinary old birds, except that it's a psalm of praise to God for creation. In the next three usages where you find this, and there are many others besides this, but just these three, these texts in Daniel and Ezekiel are texts that compare kingdoms to a tree. The first time a kingdom is compared to a tree is Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar. Thanks, dear. Okay, Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians. Nebuchadnezzar is compared to a tree that is so tall that all the birds of the air nest in this tree's branches. And in some places it even says, and the nations of the earth gathered in the shade. In Ezekiel, this tree is then compared to Egypt. See, all the different powers keep getting compared to trees. And you find the same image And then in Ezekiel 17, the tree is compared, cedar of Lebanon, is compared to Israel. Because this is symbolic language, that is where the reference to the birds of the air symbolizing the Gentiles or the nations of the earth has come. You will not find a phrase that says, the birds of the air are the nations of the world. Where New Testament scholars have come up with the phrase is through rabbinical commentary. When the Jewish teachers of the law studied these texts, they are the ones that have used the phrase birds of the air as the nations of the earth. So that's where this phrase comes from and why it might have that significance in Luke, where it's used in the parable of the sower, that the seeds are picked up by the birds of the air and devoured. I just wanted to make sure some background here. What was so nice this morning is Lori was here and she said, and I said, what? She said, I've heard that too in my classes. I said, yes. Okay. I didn't think I got this out of thin air. But that this is another one of these traditional things I don't even think about, you know, showing background for. But this is largely out of which it comes, and it has been, I'd say, our Jewish commentaries that largely have done that kind of thing. I don't know if that helps or not, but I feel better knowing that I cover my bases and at least continue to try to have some integrity in what I'm saying. Any questions about either the yield or the birds? Okay. We're going to take a look now at this interpretation of the parable of the sower. And you'll need one of those, or you need to be able to look on one. Some new folks have come in. Do we have some extras around?
Yeah, here they are.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you brought yours, great. If not, you know, there's another one for you. Between the parable's telling and the interpretation of the parable as given is some pieces of information in Mark and some in the Gospels that deal with why Jesus told in parables. And what's so interesting about that is that there seems to be, in one gospel, an indication that Jesus did parable talk on purpose so that he would not allow people to understand, except those who could. And then there's some scripture cited, and I always tell folks, always look up those references. Don't just take them face value in your New Testament. Look them up and read the context, the theology in which they are held. Because in this case, in this quote that comes between the parable and the interpretation, which is a quote out of, I think, Isaiah, it's what Jesus doesn't say that's important. The hearers that walked the face of the earth with Jesus were very literate in their understanding of the scriptures. And so he quotes this phrase, and then he stops right at the point of the good news of the phrase. And it's basically like a sin of commission or sin of omission. It's what you don't do that gets you in trouble. In Jesus' case, it's what he doesn't say that gets him in trouble. So be aware that even that between the parable and the parable's interpretation, there is something going on there that the disciples end up coming to Jesus saying, well, how are we supposed to understand these parables if you don't tell us? He says, you still don't get it? And so he says, then he starts this interpretation. Now, I want to be just upfront with you to say that in a lot, and I mean a lot, of modern scholarship, they do not feel that the interpretation is the authentic words of Jesus, but that this is the construction of the church. I do not buy it. I believe that Jesus interpreted the parable. I think that Matthew, Mark, and Luke each take the interpretation and again apply it to their community. And so we're at a second level already of Bible study when we even look at that approach. What the words of Jesus are is going to be impossible to tell because you're going to have three versions right here. Which one did he actually say? Which called? Matthew, Mark, or Luke? Well, that's the argument that they can deal with on Jesus seminar days out back east somewhere. I'm not concerned because I'm dealing with the second level already, which says that I believe that Jesus said something in the interpretation, and now I can get a gist of what it might have been and how it's applied to three different church communities, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, wherever they were, whoever they were. Let's take a look at Mark in the middle column, and read the interpretation and use this one as our pivotal point, as the point of our of pivot, and we'll look at the Matthew and Luke in comparison. Someone want to read for us Mark 13 through the end of that, 20. Please, go for it.
Said to them, "Do you not understand this parable? How then will you understand all the parables? The sower sows the word, and these are the ones along the path where the word is sown, but they hear. Satan immediately comes and takes away the word which is sown in them, and these in like manner are the ones sown upon the rocky ground, who, when they hear the word, immediately receive it with joy, and they have no root in themselves, but endure for a while. Then when tribulation or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately they fall away. And others are the ones sown among thorns. They are those who hear the word, but the cares of the world and the delight in riches and the desire for other things enter in and choke the word, and it proves unfruitful. But those that were sown upon the good soil are the ones who hear the word and accept it and bear fruit, 30-fold and 60-fold and 100-fold."
We'll use this as our standard base of interpretation. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to read Mark again, and I'm going to ask you to look at Matthew on the left column as I read the center column. Make your circles, check things that seem different. How is Matthew taking the, remember, Matthew and Luke both have Mark. They could copy him verbatim if they wanted to, but they chose not to. Why? That's our question in some ways. So I'll read Mark, you look at Matthew and see what Matthew changes, perhaps, cushions, takes out, puts in, whatever. Then we're going to ask questions after we do this again with Luke. "And he said to them, 'Do you not understand this parable? How then will you understand all the parables? The sower sows the word. And these are the ones along the path," the way again, "where the word is sown. When they hear, Satan immediately comes and takes away the word which is sown in them." And these in like manner are the ones sown upon rocky ground, who, when they hear the word, immediately receive it with joy, and they have no root in themselves, but endure for a while. Then, when tribulation or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately they fall away. And others are the ones sown among thorns. They are those who hear the word, but the cares of the world and the delight in riches and the desire for other things enter in and choke the word, and it proves unfruitful. But those that were sown upon the good soil are the ones who hear the word and accept it and bear fruit, 30-fold and 60-fold and 100-fold. Okay. Now I want to read Mark as you look at Luke. "And he said to them, 'Do you not understand this parable? How then will you understand all the parables? The sower sows the word. And these are the ones along the path where the word is sown. When they hear, Satan immediately comes and takes away the word which is sown in them. And these in like manner are the ones sown upon rocky ground, who, when they hear the word, immediately receive it with joy, and they have no root in themselves, but endure for a while. Then, when tribulation or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately they fall away. And others are the ones sown among thorns. They are those who hear the word, but the cares of the world and the delight in riches and the desire for other things enter in. It proves unfruitful. But those that were sown upon the good soil are the ones who hear the word and accept it and bear fruit 30-fold and 60-fold and 100-fold. Now our job is, as a group, who probably each of us have picked out a few of the things that may be unique or different, is for me to list what you found. Someone start somewhere and give me something you see that jumped out at you from one of these three.
The very last thing, bring forth fruit with patience.
Okay, in Luke. Okay, what else?
In Luke, I notice there's no mention of sowing.
Okay, how so?
Well, it says some seeds fell among thorns.
Okay. Do you see that? That in Mark and in Matthew, especially, there is some sense that the seeds are sown in the thorns and sown on the rocky soil and sown. But in Luke has the sense of falling.
Like it's an accident.
Right. In Isaiah 28, God gives us a farming lesson. This is part of my explanation from yesterday, too, and I just slipped my mind this morning. From the sense of the yield and the way things were sown. In Isaiah 28, God gives us a farming lesson in which he talks about wheat being sown in rows, cumin being scattered, and then another crop being planted.
Mustard.
Three different Hebrew words, sown, scattered, planted. The text reads, a farmer doesn't prepare the field plowing it forever. He eventually has to do something, and so he sows the wheat in rows, scatters the dill, or cumin, or whichever it was, and plants the mustard, among other things. There are two understandings of agricultural process. The one I told you about yesterday, which basically is digging the furrows and sowing the seeds. The other method, which I'm not an adherent of necessarily, but it, in some ways it, I don't know that it makes a lot of difference. Again, when we get to the end, it's kind of like, well, so what? Is that the seed was sown first all over the ground, and then the farmer came and plowed it under. You have occasionally in the scriptures the reference to sowing and plowing, not plowing and sowing. Now, in any case, the concept that it seems to be happening here is the intentionality of sowing and the accident of falling. Just a little change, perhaps, of dimension. And the reason I say that is because I'm going back to my Hebrew understanding that sowing means to sow wheat in rows, which you don't scatter, obviously. You dig the furrow and you put the seeds in, like I said yesterday. We don't know what kind of crop this is. And I'm not certain Jesus is trying to teach us agriculture here. But he is giving us an example of something, and it's not so much what he says as much as what each of these authors seem to mold this a bit. Again, Luke could have chosen the word sown, but he doesn't. He chooses a totally different Greek word to follow. Why? Well, let's keep going. Other things that you notice different.
Mark seems to chastise them first.
Okay, how so?
Do you not understand this parable?
Yeah, and I don't know that they don't in Matthew and Luke either. We don't, you know, this is the problem when you cut this stuff off like this on a page. And so I'm not, that's good, but I don't know that that's not also there. But yes, he does. He does use this kind of as a sense of frustration. Don't you understand this? Isn't this clear at the nose of your face? No. How are you going to understand any of them, Matt?
They each use a different, this Matthew says the evil one, and
okay.
Mark says the Satan.
Isn't that interesting?
And Luke says the devil.
Satan, evil one, devil.
Other way around.
Oh, sorry. And this is this way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
that. I don't know what the significance of that, but it sure is interesting. Satan always means the one who accuses. Just as trivia. Yeah, what else do you notice?
Matthew has it in his singular. He falls away.
Yes.
The other two are...
And it's exact opposite from the actual parable.
Very good. It's the exact opposite. Yeah. And that's why there are those that say Jesus didn't tell the interpretation because he's not consistent with himself. I don't know. Whatever.
Matthew has this in your heart. Luke has it from your heart. Mark doesn't say anything about your heart.
Okay, right. Start noticing the sense of spirituality. Not here. That suddenly, it's like things are becoming more spiritualized, aren't they? In your heart. Almost like it's almost starting to sound like Christians of the more, I don't know what you want to call it, more praise tradition type Christians, talking about the heart and soul and spirit, you know, just interesting. Other things that you notice that
Luke seems to be concentrating on the concept of salvation a lot.
Yeah, he does. Notice in verse 12, that they may not believe and be saved. This phrase, believe and be saved. Do you see it anywhere else? That the sowing of the seed has something to do with believing and being saved, at least explicitly. Certainly Matthew talks about being sown in our heart. Luke talks about it being, or Matthew, Mark talks about it being sown in us, in them. And but Luke says, takes away the word from their hearts that they may not believe and be saved. And that is a theological statement of Luke's community, that Jesus wants you to believe and be saved. And it appears in the parable.
That's right in the same place in the parable as the birds of the air statement. In the interpretation, he doesn't say anything about the birds of the air, but where that should
yes,
be in there is
right
where he's talking about believing and being saved.
Right. Luke seems to have a much more of a community that is Gentile-oriented. You know that from the Gospel of Acts, which is his other work. You've got the Gospel being preached in amazing places, you know, right? To the eunuch with Philip in the chariot, and to the Samaritans, and to all these places, and it's just like the Word of God just isn't limited to the Jewish community. And I think Luke is as God's instrument here, is trying to expand from Mark, who basically, I think, deals more with a Jewish audience than a Gentile audience, simply by the earliness of the gospel and the lateness.
You know, I hear this over and over again, that these writers craft the sermon or the parable according to specific audiences, and so it becomes their design. But I often wonder, didn't Jesus preach these same things since he was an itinerant in various places? And those of us that have served multiple parishes, mm-hmm. our sermon's not exactly the same. We may make a point at the last place and bring in, like, believe and be saved that we didn't say at the other two places.
Okay. But I still think even if Jesus does that, it still implies that he is crafting it for an audience. Just like when I go to one church, I can't preach the same sermon at another church. It does get a little bit shaped for that community versus that community. So whether it's the author who crafts or Jesus, fine. You know, I no problem with that. That takes a step back, and that if that integrity of Scripture is important to you, you might want to choose that. That these are Jesus' words in three different settings. But again, the setting keeps changing, perhaps. That's fine, too. I mean, who am I to say? I mean, you know, you're an adult. You'll choose where you need to go. So that's fine. With me, as teacher, fine. Other things you notice?
Tribulation or persecution rises.
Where?
In both Matthew and Mark, but Luke uses in time of temptation fall away.
What does that suggest to you? What's the difference between persecution, tribulation, and temptation in its meaning?
Temptation to me is something that that seems desirable, that is not okay for you to have, maybe.
Okay.
Temptation is maybe more inward as opposed to tribulation, or
yeah,
persecution wouldn't necessarily be.
Yeah.
Okay. Tends to seem to focus again on Luke's emphasis, heart, believe and be saved, inward. Now, slide shift here a bit.
But even with tribulation, persecution, the temptation is to back off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're right.
Not stand up.
Okay. Other things you notice? Right. What I want to do a little bit here is talk about, I think what the best thing for me to do is, now that you see some of these emphases, to talk and tell you simply what I do with the three. Then you can choose to do as you need to. The one thing that is missing up here that we have not talked about is the statement, what? The sower sows the word. Do you find that in any other gospel? The sower in Matthew and Luke seems to have completely been forgotten. In this one, it says, what? The seed is the word of God. The W of G, okay? How does Matthew start?
When anyone hears the word of the kingdom, okay, does not understand.
Matthew is dealing with the word of the kingdom. Kingdom. The other night at our forum, we talked about pastoral responsibility and how the scriptures are used. And the question that was raised in the forum had to do with that text from Ephesians saying, maybe it's not the most pastoral thing in the world to do to read a text in which you have a lot of people coming in who have no clue what it's about and end up being abused by the text or using it as a case to abuse others. And the case was meant that this text from Ephesians about wives being subject to husband has been used to make a lot of women stay in relationships they should not stay in, where there's a beating and different kinds of abuse, and saying you have to stay there because you need to be subject. Okay, so let's set that aside, but what I want to pick up is that concept of responsibility for how a Bible passage is used. What I tremble with when I hear the parable of the sower is that often it has been used as a parable of judgment. Oftentimes it gets used as a parable of self-reflection. That's not quite in the same token. But a parable of judgment, meaning that stand up and warn everybody not to be thorns and not to be bad soil and not to be birds of the air, not to be this and not to be that. Well, dear friends, the problem of where the seed is sown means the responsibility for that seed lies with whom? The soil? The sower. The thorns cannot be other than thorns. The birds will not be other than birds. So if the seed gets sown in those places, the responsibility is not to yell at the soil and say, you bad soil, you, but to think about the role of the sower. If we use the parable, especially Mark's parable, and say that this has to do with the judgment of people right now in terms of whether you're being a faithful Christian or not, or even what is going to happen at the end of the world, I think that we're dangerously close to using the parable as a weapon of judgment. I back up from that about 2,000 years. And I want to talk to you a little bit about how I see Mark, who I think is, because the first of the Gospels has a more original sense, perhaps, of how this parable might be interpreted to get away from it being a weapon. This is the first teaching of Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. This is the first time he has opportunity to teach about what he's going to be saying. This parable is not a reflection on our time. It's a reflection, I think, of Jesus describing his own ministry. He is the sower of the seed. And he is going to be one that throughout his ministry is going to sow that seed in the most unusual places, intentionally, not accidentally, intentionally. He's going to sow it on the hard, rocky places. He's going to sow it in the thorns. He's going to sow it in places that have no possibility, at least in our own idea, of possibly bearing fruit. Doesn't he do that throughout his ministry? Who does he go to see? The tax collectors and the sinners. Well, what chance is there of that seed being born to fruit? Or with the people caught in different sin? Or in whatever the circumstances are, he always seems to be the sower, sowing the seed in the places where it's least likely to grow. And I think the picture of the sower from Mark as Jesus is that is that indeed the sower sows the word. And he's going to take a chance and show the grace of God by going to people that normally would never have been gone to. That's my way of looking at the Markan parable. It's a description of Jesus' ministry, not some sort of warning to you and me about our time and our life. Pulling it to this side, to Matthew, we begin, I think, in Matthew to see that Matthew is backing away a little bit from this as a description of Jesus' life to a description of life in the church of Matthew's time. It's the word still gets sown. It gets sown in the heart. There's the evil one. But look at it, it's becoming a personal and individual responsibility. Instead of a description of once, it's now he and she, me and mine. And there is tribulation and persecution in this time. And certainly there are people in Matthew's time and life that fell away under persecution. And then when we move to Luke, we're moving yet even further along in time and seeing how the church again uses the parable of the sower as a description. But this time, again, we're moving more into a concern dealing with salvation issues. And instead of there being tribulation and persecution, that time is past in Luke. It is now an inward struggle to stay faithful. My way of coming to this has come because of the last statement in each of these Gospels in the interpretation. Take a look at it. Verse 20 of Mark reads, "But those that were sown upon the good soil are the ones who hear the word and accept it and bear fruit 30, 60-fold, and 100-fold. But look how Matthew ends it. As for what was sown on good soil, this is he who hears the word and understands it. He indeed bears fruit and yields in one case 100-fold, in another case 60, and in another 30. In Matthew's community, he's already realizing that not all the good soil is going to keep yielding all these wonderful numbers, but that in fact, as individuals, we each are going to bear differently according to the grace that God has given us. But his concern is not that the word simply accepted. That would be Jesus' life, that people would accept what he has to say, that he is the Son, whatever it is you want Jesus' message to be or need it to be, that word anyway is accepted. By Matthew's time, they're a little bit further down the line, and it's not just important that people just accept, oh, I believe in Jesus, but they understand what Jesus meant when he taught and what he said. And of course, Jesus and Matthew is a teacher. And there's all that teaching about the Ten Commandments that are renewed again, and he finds the relational in the Sabbath, and he does all of these wonderful things, but it's important that they understand, not just sit there and give lip service, and that if they do understand, every individual will yield, but they may yield differently. But look at how Luke ends this gospel, ends this interpretation, and you are right on. "And as for that in the good soil, they are those who, hearing the word, hold it fast in an honest and good heart and bring forth fruit with patience." What seems to be going on in Luke's version of this? Well, who needs to hear this parable as it's interpreted by Luke? Is it just those who've just come to faith, or those that are learning what the faith means?
Those who are struggling with something.
Yeah. Those who seem to be struggling to hold on. In fact, the one version is the Greek word is to hold it fast in a noble heart and to bring forth fruit with endurance. The word for patience isn't just passive. It means to endure. It means to hold on for with both hands. The parable of the sower used and then interpreted three kind of different emphases. Same parable, basically the same interpretation, but three ways of looking at it. For me, the Gospel of Mark is a description of Jesus' own ministry. That's why he starts with this parable. It sets the tone, saying, I'm going to go and I'm going to cast this on rocky ground. Now think about the rocky ground, if that's a description of someone whose name means rock. Peter. Look at this. And these in like manner are ones sown upon rocky ground, who when they hear the word immediately receive it with joy, and they have no root in themselves, but endure for a while. Then, when a tribulation or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately they fall away. It's as if Jesus is saying, there are those among you who are, you know, don't understand what the consequence of the word will be in your life. And you can look at another one and apply it to Judas. You can apply this to all kinds of people. Have a lot of fun with it in the scriptures. But in any case, what do you think? Let me let you respond in the way you need to. Make sense? Does it make sense?
How far apart in time span these were written comparatively, or what's the context?
Well,
the
I'll give you what the scholars are thinking. They figure this is about 70 AD, just at the Adam during the destruction of the temple and a real civil war that was breaking out. The Romans had to come in and just sit on the people. Really a bad situation. In Mark 13, we talk about the desolating image coming into the city and all of that. It really deals, I think, with the Roman occupation troops. The occupation army of Rome was notorious for what they were doing. And in fact, the Roman 10th Legion, which was stationed in that area, had as its symbol a wild boar. And so you know how offensive that symbol would be to be marched through the streets and into the temple. Wow. Just incredible. So the desolating sacrilege, I believe, in Mark 13 deals with this imminent problem. Matthew is often noted about 90, about 20 years later. That may be, for me, a little late. I think Matthew is a little, not quite that far out, maybe 85. This is the one that's been interesting, is Luke. It used to be thought that Luke was somewhere around the time of Matthew, but as our people are studying the languages, and especially looking at the book of Acts, which was written first, and then going from there, and just basically the description of the church community and how it's structured and the words that Luke chooses to use, city and church. He actually uses the word church in his gospel. You know, so you have to have a separate Christian church by the time of Luke. They're dating this now as late as 120, which is after the writing of John. And if you read Luke as if it was written that late, it starts making a whole lot more sense. And that's kind of the way I do it. I read this and say, does it hold water if this is the case? And I find that it does. The church in 120 is back into a time of unrest. You've got the different Caesars who are rising. The church is not the honored little flower. It's no longer the same as Judaism. It's now separate apart. And you know, this time of enduring with patience, you bet. That fits 120 very well. The rising of Nero, some of those others, the death of Peter, possibly Paul, all of that taking place somewhere before and after. And I mean, they're probably getting shaken to their core. And this parable is a parable of hope, saying, hang on, no matter how much is happening out there, it's like 75% loss, there is still an incredible return, there's still incredible success. Let us not lose heart, even though some of the seed seems to have fallen. not been stolen intentionally, but seems to just keep falling in places that are non-productive. So I don't know if that's helpful or if that's realistic or if it's important, but those are kind of the time figures that a lot of people are using accurately. Other comments on this parable?
If speaking to their times, it's kind of fascinating to kind of reflect on our times.
Yeah.
And see how the different perspectives often fit into the different time things in our lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have our times of persecution, tribulation, and then we do come to a time where we just need to hang on and need to have that faithful endurance.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of neat.
Yeah. It's bad to the sense that whenever we read the scriptures or as preachers have to teach them, it's that question of what is the appropriate word for my day? And I believe that God gives us four gospels to have at least four different perspectives on the same thing, whether as a name escapes me, was asking about Jesus possibly doing it for, but it doesn't matter to me whatever is convenient and necessary for someone to believe whatever, or whether there are four gospel writers and they live in different times doing this. But the idea is that there are at least four messages constantly being told us, and the discernment is which is the message for our day. And there are times when maybe preaching one message is not the appropriate one, and in fact may do more harm than good. I think that Matthew and Luke's parable of the sower is a parable of hope and a parable of assurance. And maybe Matthew is more of a parable of thinning people out. Luke seems to be more of assurance. And I think Mark is the description of what Jesus is going to be about. He doesn't use kingdom language at all when it comes to this parable. It's basically about the sower. And I think he is the sower. When I look at the parable, I look at it from three different topics. The title of this session was Life, Sowing, Seeds, and Soil. And I think about when I reflect only on the part of the sower, the role the sower plays, I either can look at him as very wasteful or I can look at him as extremely generous and risk-taking. And I prefer to see this sower as a real risk-taker and a generous one. That seed is precious. The Word of God is precious. But it gets sown in places maybe that anyone in common sense knows doesn't grow in thorns. It doesn't grow on the path. This doesn't take a miracle to understand this. This is just what we know. But the fact the sower does it seems to be a little bit, whoa. The freedom of the sower to do that is wonderful. The freedom of God to be God to a lot of different people or situations. Then I look at the seeds and I say, you know, those seeds are so tiny and yet so powerful. The Word of God can be so small at times and sometimes so subtly even conveyed. And yet what it grows, what it blossoms in is incredible. Powerful, powerful seed. The soil. This is the one that gets us in trouble because this is the one we're more likely to follow Matthew and make it personal. Soil is different people. What I do to try to keep myself away from that is to talk about the soil as the seasons of my own life. I am all those soils. I'm not just the good soil. Oh, I'd like to be. And there may be times in my life when the good soil does produce a lot. But there are other times when I am those that seed that gets sown on the path of my life and the distractions of my life just pick it up before I even know God is asking me of something new or giving me something to be about that's gone. Or the thorn bushes. How many times does God sow in my life and all of a sudden it comes along and there's nothing left of it because stuff in my life chokes it out. Or perhaps around the rocky soil. Sure, it springs up for a while and pretty soon, oh yeah, and off I go and I'm going in a different direction. But the good news of that is that, however, whenever it falls in the good soil, the harvest is so fantastic. And it's so much more than I could ever expect it to be. That's really, really good news. This morning, I asked, so when I teach this in my classes, I asked if they would like to retitle the parable according to Matthew, Mark, or Luke. And, you know, basically, does the parable of the sower, for me, fits very well for Mark? But it may not fit as well for Matthew or for Luke. And I'm always encouraging people to think of new titles, because that helps us remember what the gist is for us of that particular text.